I just want to start off with just making some statements about what we are, who we are, and who we're not. We're not parenting experts. We don't have it down. We have our oldest is 4, so we have a lot of learning ahead of us. Mostly what we are offering to you is just an experience and how the gospel ministered to us when we felt that we were failing as parents, and how did we hear a different message from the gospel, and how did that then give us affect how we approached our parenting, or not like techniques, but just how we looked at it. So I think that first what we'll do is we'll start with sharing some of our experiences. First, we'll share about our experience in regards to the expectations we had prior to the birth of our first son. And it's important to listen to this one and then the experience of what really was reality after he was born, because that's where the kind of the crash occurs. And I'll start. My husband and I met in seminary, and we got married in seminary, and then I had my first son in my last year of seminary. And when I was pregnant, I had this idea that when my boy was born, that I would sling him up and I would go to classes with him, and I would go to the library and I would research, and that I would be the picture of Christian maternalness, that I would just be calm and loving and always tender, and which in reality, I'm actually none of these things. But for some reason, I was looking for the ontological change. And I really just thought that I was going to be a penultimate mother. I'm not from a Christian family. I was convinced I was going to do everything differently. I was going to be calmer than my mother was. I was never going to yell. I was never going to get frustrated. I was never going to get to the point of shaking my child. I was always going to be able to soothe him. Like I was going to be the picture of what it means to be a mother. Very idyllic. And that was my expectations of what was going to happen.
I kind of had this thought before we had a child, and I didn't rationally believe this, but I honestly thought somewhere in my head that when Quinn came out, our first son, that he would be able to talk, and that I would be able to reason with him. And if he had some issue, he could explain it to me, and then I could take care of it for him. And I don't think I really believe that, but a little bit I did. And I think the root of that was that I thought I could be in control of parenting my son. And kind of like what Lauren was saying, I looked at being a parent as this kind of new chance to kind of have a new identity that wasn't soiled like my previous identities had been. Kind of like that ontological change that I could start over and kind of live out this perfect parenting role that I had assigned for myself.
Yeah, the dad-tological change.
It doesn't sound as good.
No. Mom-tological is much better. In the reality, my son, I may cry because it's a very personal thing for me, but my son was born about 8 days early, not a big deal. And he came out sounding like, I referenced it on the blog just briefly, but he sounded like a prehistoric creature. I was like, put it back. It's not done. He screamed and screamed, and I nursed and nursed and nursed, and the nurses in the hospital were telling me, you can't keep that up, there's no way, you need to start formula feeding. And I was adamant, and I'm hard-headed, he can speak to it, and I was determined, and I spent 2 weeks really calm and controlled, and I had all these tricks that I would do to keep myself calm, and he just screamed and screamed and screamed, and it was hour on hour, and when I could sleep, it was 5 seconds, and then finally he would start screaming again, and it just, my whole world just started unraveling within 14 days, and I finally just started to lose it, we had only been married about 15 months when we had our first son, and that was, we had probably one night our son was screaming, and I was desperately delirious, and I couldn't nurse him anymore, and Daniel blessedly took him for an hour. For me, the sleep felt about 5 minutes, and Daniel woke me up desperate because the child's screaming and said, I think he needs to eat. And I dropped the hugest F-bomb, directed at my son, who's probably 15 days old. And I just couldn't tolerate it. I couldn't do it. It was the beginning of what was going to be months and months of, like, progressing down further and further into a darkness of losing control. And the ultimate reality was, and this is actually this story of my parenting, is actually instrumental in my radical change in my theology. I remember one morning, about a month before I really comprehended Paul Zell's message of one-way love through the gospel, I remember it was probably 4 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and someone in another room was screaming, and I remember swinging my legs over the side and saying, "I need to stay in control. I need to get it together, because if I don't, I'm going to kill my son." And, like, it was on my shoulders to control myself, and I remember just going in there and picking him up and being so tense that I wasn't shaking, but just my whole body was shaking, and then he was sort of vibrating, and just hearing this voice, I don't know if it was God, but it wasn't my voice, some external voice, just say, "Put the baby down, go slam a door." And I put the baby down, and I slammed a door, and I lived like that for probably about 7 months. And our child is very high maintenance, and he's really intricate, and he's very verbal, and he says a lot of things just right off the top of his head. But it was 7 months of just dealing with this. I have to keep my temper. I have to stay controlled, because if I don't, I'm going to ruin him. I might end his life. I'm going to ruin him. I'm going to ruin his relationship with God. I'm going to ruin everything about him. He's going to be a neurotic mess. And so that's where I wound up prior to sort of hearing the gospel message and then being saved again.
I mean, I had basically a similar experience, but just as I was saying in my expectations, I just expected to be in control. And what I found was that I was totally out of control in ways that I never thought possible. Quinn was 100% not rational and totally out of my control. And ultimately, I just felt that I was failing at this new identity that I had given myself. You know, that I was failing as a parent, and then what was left was kind of where I was left with that.
So I'm not doing well holding both things. Ultimately, we were plagued with fear and failure. We were not only failing ourselves and the identities that we had built, but we were failing God. We were failing our children. And our verdict, according to that, was that we were unfit to be parents. And that was a statement that I had made many times, that I was unfit, that I should never have procreated. Maybe it's still true, actually. You get to know me. this is casual, so if you have questions or you would like to direct me in whichever way, that would be great. I can amend whatever I say.
My name is Catherine Green McCrite. I don't need
okay.
The mic. I'm loud. I was just going to say, when you said you felt like you were an unfit mother, you were. In
right.
fact, we all are unfit parents.
Right.
So I came here to learn how I failed, because mm-hmm. my kids are now 18 and 21, and so now that I'm a failure as an adult mom, where to go?
Right. And is it inappropriate to say that I love your book?
No.
Darkness is my only... I loved it. parents are completely bombarded with loads of parenting, what I call parenting propaganda. From books to items, from philosophies to opinions, our society has notoriously endorsed the idea that we can, if we try hard enough and work hard enough and do everything right, raise the perfect child. A child who will grow to be an adult that is free of insecurities and baggage, an adult with perfect and healthy relationships, confident, able to be free of all issues normally associated with general humanity. In general, our society knowingly and unknowingly has swallowed whole the idea that it is possible to raise or create the perfect adult, and the burden of that has fallen on us, parents. Even recently, there was a Facebook article that was it was suggesting a certain type of parenting. And the result was that your child would be more moral. And I thought, from a gospel look, I said, do I really want my child to be more moral and possibly not need Jesus? So I was like, I'm not going to do that parenting. and try as you may to find that one book that is free of the do this's and do that's, you won't. Even the most innocent looking book harbors within its covers tricks and tips to avoid fussing or conquer sleeplessness, and in doing so, raising the happiest baby on the block. Wow. Essentially, the claim is that through my parenting, I can raise someone who will have the qualities that I myself am so desperately in need of, and thus why I gravitate towards the cross. So let's ask the question, can I raise the perfect child to be the perfect adult who is more moral and compassionate, more intelligent and insightful than I am? Can I myself be that perfect parent? The answer to this is no. So what happens when I'm indoctrinated with these ideas that my parenting, perfect or imperfect, will result in a certain type of child, perfect or imperfect? Well, when I fail to do the right thing, whatever that right thing is, I will fail myself and my child. When I can't get my child to stop screaming, I may be plagued with the idea that every minute that lapses is one more minute of brain damage. And I have seen this argument all throughout Facebook, which means my son screaming for 4 months. Should not have read prior to turning four. When I can't get my child to sleep through the night, even with all the tips and tricks ever given, my child will somehow suffer, and I'm obviously not doing something right. Every issue my child has will be a result of something I did wrong, not the result of a fallen world, but a result of my wrongdoing. Consequently, my child's success becomes my success. I raised the right child. To some degree, maybe even to a great degree, our children become extensions of our identity. Depending on our children and their future, and maybe even current, I'm either a good parent or a bad parent. And for me, the best example is when your child has a huge tantrum in the market or a restaurant. And what's the thing you think about? What's everyone thinking about me? You get that child out of there as fast as possible. Or even a good moment where child throws a huge fit in a store and you're just this picture of complete peacefulness, like, oh, sweet child, it's okay. So there's just those, like, you want to look like the good parent, you don't want to look like the bad parent. So not only is my child's vitality and future wrapped up in me, but his or her vitality is one of the bases of my identity. The problem, and this is my observation, I'm still trying to work this out theologically, is that our culture, society, have been so desperate to find a new source for morality and perfection. Apart from the gospel, and I can qualify that I don't think the gospel is where we find how to be moral and how to be perfect, but it is the message of Jesus who is perfect. And in light of that and the cross event, I see my failure and how I fail and how I need something outside of myself. Apart from the gospel message of one-way love, and in that desperation has landed its sights on the parents, certainly we can pin everything on them. There's been a huge transition towards parenting books and what to do, and it's recent. This isn't, I mean, my mom had one book, and it was Dr. Spock. I have 20, and there's more out there that are recommended to me on a daily basis, so it's a really new way to help parents raise that perfect child. And then also from a Christian culture's perspective, it's frequently, you'll hear, there's an attempt to place your child's future relationship with God square on your shoulders. If it is up to us, apart from sharing the pure message of the gospel, well then, there's a good chance none of our children will even know, will care to want to know Jesus and the message of the cross. And in that, I say, I'm a perfect example in the sense that my parents are agnostic. And their preferred method of disciplining was my mom loved yelling and grounding, and my dad ignored me when he was angry. And I think that if my relationship with Christ was dependent on that, there's no way that I would have been Christian. So if it is all up to me, then all the evidence that I see points to the fact that I fail and that I am failing my child. And even failing God because I'm failing my child's future with him. And let's not even talk about joy and enjoying parenting, because now that is completely off the table. So how does the gospel address this failure, which is what your question was? as recipients of the gospel message, which is the message of the justification of sinners. And you will hear me say that a lot. And you will hear me say you are defined apart from your works. You are justified apart from your works. You will hear me say that a lot. And if that is the one thing you walk away from, that will be that's a good day for me. as recipients of the gospel message, which is the message of the justification of sinners, you, me, our children, present and future, Jesus died for them and their trespasses too. How does this same message address my parenting? What is the gospel message of the justification of sinners? And you can refer to a number of passages in Romans and Galatians. And then what I have here is that the gospel message is this in brief. Jesus died and was raised to redeem us from our transgressions and the sure consequence of those transgressions, death. And in his being raised, we are justified. We are accounted his, forgiven, righteous by faith and not by works. In the gospel message is this very declaration, by faith, not by works. Hinged to this declaration is the other and just as awesome declaration that declares you are forgiven, justified, accounted righteous. Again, all of it apart from your works. In fact, in the message of the gospel of the justification of sinners is the established concrete statement that your deeds and your person are so utterly separated that you are not defined by those very works, good or bad. I cannot realize myself or actualize myself by my works, let alone actualize another person by works, specifically my child. I cannot control myself nor conform myself into someone I think I should be. I cannot gain myself by working. I need to be given myself. And I'm only truly given myself when I lose myself. Matthew 10:39, whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Matthew 16:25, for whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. In losing myself, I am associated with Christ in his death, and out of this death, given new life, life that is not justified by works or deeds. The world may judge this way. We can't avoid that. But as Luther said, it is not this way with God. And I have in bold, and it's highlighted about a million times. You are not justified by works or deeds, not even defined by them. You are only justified by faith in Christ and defined by that event. In this declaration and definition, I am apart from my works and deeds, lies the freedom to fail. And this is where I get emotional because I fail on a daily basis. Everything isn't hinged on my success, specifically my children's future. It is not hinged on me having every perfect action down pat. I can fail and I will fail, and that's quite all right. If it is up to me, as I thought it was a month or so, as I was shared about becoming more law gospelly oriented, then it will end badly. I remember, I shared this, that I remember the palpable feeling of having to have control or it was over. Everything is not riding on finding the exact right parenting method or practice or trick. Also, to a great extent, since I'm given myself and losing myself, I am free to be exactly the parent I am with all my quirks, foibles, follies, and maybe even a few okay things, in quotes, thrown in there. You are free and loosed from the oppression of a parenthood radically defined by works, guilt, and doubt. You are free to fail, free to try, and not succeed. Also in the gospel message is the freedom to differentiate between good and bad. I can, in fact, knowing where my roots are rooted in the gospel, disregard any and all propaganda that is thrown at me. And I bring this up because there's been a lot of dialogue about, well, when I read this certain book on how to get my baby to sleep or how to get my baby to do this or that, there's a lot of law. And someone asked me, how can you read those books and not feel the law that they're giving you? And I say, because I can cast it out. I have this message. I have the message of the gospel. And that is the message that I look through to decide whether or not something is actually saying the truth, whether or not something is good or bad. So I can see in the sleep books that, yes, it's important for my child to have sleep. But I'm not necessarily certain that if they ever miss one night of 12 hours of sleep, that they're going to wind up probably not getting into Harvard. I don't have to worry about that aspect of it. If they're not the happiest baby on the block, doesn't mean that they're definitely not going to be the happiest adult. There's no correlation there. It's all a philosophy that's been sold just to a point that I actually get pretty worked up about it. Sold to parents with this tag that's like, here is your way to have a successful child. And it's a lie. And the gospel message tells me that. And I can read these books and I can extract the information that I need to. So that's how I respond to that. God is bigger than any of my chosen parenting methods and what I like to call unmethods when I'm kind of winging it. I know it's not great to yell, but yell I do, because me never yelling is never going to happen. I'm going to yell. I have baggage, and the kids, they are actually born with baggage. They're not clean slates. And parenting, I call it just a delicate balance between fighting with each other's baggage and neatly placing the baggage down in the right spot. Some days are good, and some days the luggage is just being swung all over the place. The gospel will never call my yelling good. It's good. It's not good. Losing my temper is never good. It is wrong. But according to the gospel, I am told that I am forgiven when I do such things. But still, you have the Paul caution, we don't lose our tempers or yell at our children to have grace abound. So I want to throw that in there. I'm not advocating just going home and yelling at all your kids and being like, I'm forgiven. It is good to have conviction, conviction which leads to repentance and prayer for strength and help. I believe that the gospel brings good conviction. I don't really need some book or person to judge me and tell me that I'm failing or how I should be loving my children. I just really need to hear the gospel message and allow that message to penetrate my heart and show me where I'm wrong. Condemnation is another thing. Condemnation comes from the law, specifically when you feel you are the final word because you are failing and there's no relief from that. The buck stops with you would be a good phrase for that condemnation. The failure reflects you on you personally. You failed, and that's the final word. There's nothing bigger than you.
Lauren asked me to do something for this talk. obviously, she's the one that's good at this. But I was thinking about the difference between condemnation and conviction, because I think in some ways they can be confused. And I think at the root of it, both of them are telling you that something is wrong. But the difference between condemnation and conviction is where you place your identity. If you're placing your identity first and foremost as a parent, if that's who you are, then when you fail and you realize that you fail or you've done something wrong, then your identity itself is crushed, and that's when you feel condemned. If your identity is first and foremost as a redeemed sinner, when you fail as a parent, you can feel conviction and know that you failed, but your identity can remain secure.
And Romans 8:1, therefore there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. There is a significant difference between conviction and condemnation. As mentioned above, often the Christian culture can make us think that our children's faith and relationship with God is dependent on our parenting. That's a nice burden. Yes, we all have issues from our parents, and we do, in fact, bring those problems into our relationship with Christ. It is true. This does not mean that your parenting determines your child's relationship with Christ. Faith is a gift. It is not from us, the parents, but from God. And that's from 1 Corinthians 1:18-31. Faith is a gift. God bestows it himself. We cannot make our kids into believers. The only thing we can do and we should do is proclaim the gospel message in its entirety. No child would be so far out of God's reach because of the ills of someone's parenting. And as I said earlier, I'm case in point. they're like the next Christian in my family, like going up generations, was like my great, great, great aunt. And there's a lot of generations in between there. So The unique way that this is also some of the aspects of having a freedom to fail is that the unique way that you are a parent to your child will be a mix of weaknesses and strengths. And these weaknesses and strengths will affect your and impact your child. I give some personal examples. As I said, I thought I was going to be really maternal, and it turned out that I actually wasn't that soft and cuddly. And so my child, like, that is a weakness. Like, I do wish I was more, wanted to be more hands-on or more just in their lives, but I'm not. But one of the strengths of those, of that same sort of quirk in my personality is that I have given my children enough space to be independent, to be individuals, to be, they play by themselves for hours. And they don't expect me to entertain them or, so there are strengths and there are weaknesses and we do pass those on. And so my children, do come to me for comfort, but I once bemoaned to Daniel, I was like, they never cry when I leave. Well, you've prepared them every day of their life that you may leave. So, do you have any examples?
I'm the maternal one. No, I mean, just my biggest weakness, I think, is just my level of tolerance for things that frustrate me is in the basement. So, I know that impacts my kids. That's an area of conviction for me. But I am, you know, verbalizing affection is something that I do well with my children. So.
And then this is why I would say that it's important to keep hearing the gospel message on a regular basis. Yeah, certainly.
So I have an 11-month-old daughter, and I was raised in a Christian home, but not enough. Like, we went to church, but no one ever, there was no gospel proclaimed. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Really. So I take my daughter to a Bible study. She goes to class there. We have that part of our routine at church. But in terms of at home, I don't want to get into like this control thing.
Right.
But just in terms of getting comfortable with it, but then just making it part of, oh, that's just part of our everyday kind of thing we do, what would you say?
Oh, well, 11 months is... Is, I mean, she's not gonna, right. But just in, like, I think a great entry point is our kids love this children's Bible called the Jesus Storybook Bible. And that's just a great, honestly, the pictures, I don't know how verbal she is or, you know, but she will very fast become even more verbal. She'll ask you questions, and that's a great entry point. And we will talk about one of the aspects of being free to fail in parenting is the freedom to ask your child for forgiveness. And that is a powerful example of the gospel message. You don't need to sit her down and be like, here's the doctrine of justification. Here's Calvin. Here's Luther.
I put pressure on myself, like, we're supposed to be setting an example to my husband. It's like, I don't want to get into this thing where I'm trying to control, like, talking about it with my child.
Right.
People didn't hear it, too.
Right.
And
And this the whole conference has been oriented towards trying to control those very moments when in reality it's not up to you as it is, like, the word itself is so darn powerful that he will hear when he hears, and it's those events are very controlled by God. He knows exactly when that moment is. Okay, so that is to hear that you are free to do and to fail, and in this freedom you are free to enjoy life. And enjoy parenting mostly, or sometimes, which is better than never. I'm finishing up my second master's degree, and I wrote a thesis on a very unknown German scholar, theologian, and he talks about the uniqueness of the Christian, and I loved he. He wrote a book that was over 200 pages long, maybe close to 300, and it, like, one line stuck with me. And it was, the uniqueness of the Christian is that they can enjoy life, that they have joy because they're free from the oppression of their works. And I thought, man, that applies to parenting. So true, you can. It's possible that there may be moments where you can have true unadulterated enjoyment and joy because we are free from the oppression of our works. And that means that you're operating, you're free to be who it is, all your quirks and foibles and follies and the good things that might be thrown in there too. It's okay, you can be free to be that person. It's almost amazing that when I stop, I am always fluctuating between like trying to be the maternal perfect parent and go to school and then realizing I really can't do both and something's got to give. And when I'm over here, I'm a lot more patient with my children. I still lose. I'm going to yell. I was raised with a yeller, so it's ingrained. But there's times when I'm finally just accept that this is who Lauren is in Christ. Then I become that mom, and I love my kids, and I'm sarcastic to them, and we joke around, and I call them dude when I'm sort of angry to kind of like take the edge off what I'm about to say, and you know, I think some parents would be like, oh, that's not really gentle, but I'm like, well, you know what? I don't think I'm very gentle, so you know, and they still love me, and they're an example to me of that unyielding love because I mess up all the time, and within an hour or maybe even 5 minutes, they're like, "Hey, Mom, let's go do this fun thing," and I'm like, "Really? I just yelled at you." So in all of this parenting, we've learned valuable things. Wait, hold on a second, I skipped. So how do we parent in light of the gospel message? Because we are relying on God for our children and their future. There are times when something that can be or could be big is handled well in spite of ourselves. And when we botch it, we can ask our children for forgiveness. And there was one moment where I was dropping someone off at the hospital and kind of crunched for time. And my son has a booster seat so he can kind of get in and out of it. And he clicked his seatbelt and he was like, "Mommy, look, I'm out of my seat." And it was pure fury. And I just unleashed it on him. And he just looked at me and it was that look of, "You are so wrong right now, Mom. I did that so innocently." And it just stopped me in my tracks because I yelled at him and he was crying. And I went over and I buckled him back in and I just said, "Quinn, Mommy was wrong. Mommy should not have yelled at you like that." And I was really just convicted, but it was good. And I didn't feel condemnation. And I failed. I failed. And there you have it, Quinn. And he was fine. He received that. I said, "Do you forgive me?" And I'm not sure if he understands it yet, but I say it a lot. So, and he was like, "Yes, I do. I forgive you." And then he goes over and he like punches his brother and he's like, "Do you forgive me?" We're still working it out. So do you have,
I don't have a great example of that, but I think this is kind of the crux of this message. Because for me, the biggest pressure as a parent is that pressure to, I think especially as a father, there's this message that, you know, your relationship with God is going to be kind of predicated on your relationship with your father, and you're going to bring all that baggage into. And that's a lot of pressure for me. So, and I think the idea of me, instead of being an example to my children of God, which I know I am in some ways, and that will happen, I try to be an example to them of a sinner, you know, a redeemed sinner. I have faults and I fail them. And when I ask them for forgiveness, they can see that, you know, rather than being unapproachable or perfect, that I am, you know, in some way like them. So, and to me, I think that gives them a more enduring, I guess, legacy to follow. You know, it's okay. My dad failed. I can fail, you know. I forgive my dad. People, you know, he asked forgiveness. I can ask forgiveness. So,
yeah, and we do find that our one thing that I'm really big on that's really important to me is that I was always scared to go to my mom and tell her if something happened. And for me, the one thing is that because of the gospel message and its presence in my life and my heart, and that I'm hearing it all the time and I'm studying it all the time, is that when they come to me and they're like, "I just broke this," I can say, "That's just a thing, and that's okay." And that's the Holy Spirit working through me, but it's that they can, and it's okay. You make mistakes. They do not expect you to be perfect. You're going to break things. You're going to color Superman on the wall, and that's great. And he's been there for months and I haven't taken him down yet. Stickers everywhere. And these things are not big things. And that's the working of the Spirit in our lives. And then also, too, there's a component of this that's really important. Two things is when you've heard the gospel message and you understand that you're free to fail, you may find that you become, what I say is, you're being a friend of parents, i.e. sinners. That when you open up, you're vulnerable, you'll have people start opening up to you. And I remember sharing in a small group just all my hardship with Quinn, and a year later my friend had a baby and it turned out to be just like Quinn, and she just picked up the phone. She knew exactly who to call because I'm not going to judge. And even I remember when I was struggling with Quinn and Mary Zoll called me to ask me to do something, and she said, "Well, how's that great new baby?" And I was like, "He won't stop screaming." And she said, "That's so hard when it's your first." And I just sat on the stairs and I didn't know her well enough to actually cry, but I humped the phone. I was like, "It is, it's so hard, it's so hard." But it was so good to hear that she wasn't judging me, that she heard me. And I think that it's when you get into that vulnerable spot that really you may find that other people are actually dying to talk about how they're failing, and they want to hear the good news of the gospel. And also, too, another fruit that we have found is that we have started to see that our parents are human too, which I'm very excited about. They did what they thought was right, and the same baggage or issues, and with the same baggage or issues that I have. They were both weak and strong. And after having our first kid, we noticed that our judgment of our parents' failings began to wane. Not completely, but it started. And one experience I have is that I remember my mom, I was probably 6 or 7 months pregnant with Quinn, and she was trying to open up to me about the tendency or the temptation to shake. And she did shake both me and my brother, and she was opening up to me about that, and we were on the phone, so I could make all the eye-rolling gestures that I wanted. And she just said, "You know, Lauren, when you're there and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and he won't stop screaming and you feel that, please know that I've been there." And which was a really vulnerable thing for her to say. And I was like, "Oh yes, Mom, thank you so much." In my head, I was thinking, but I have Jesus and I'll never get to that point because I'll be calm. And there was that time. And I wanted to shake him, and it didn't happen, and I'm grateful for that. But I wanted to, and it was a real, real palpable feeling, and I wanted to. I wanted the screaming to stop, and when I look back in that moment, it causes me to have a lot more compassion for my mom, who was struggling and struggling, and with married to someone who kept saying, "Shut that kid up, just shut him up." And so she was under all this pressure. She was wrong. But I love her, and I can understand that, and it's caused me to listen to her more, and you know, like, and maybe even I can forgive her for that. I feel like we've been kind of trained over the past few decades to turn around and blame our parents for everything that we do wrong, or all of our issues and insecurities, and it's natural. Genesis 3 is a good example of that. The snake made me do it. The woman made me do it. Nothing they've done is beyond forgiveness. And as I hear the gospel message, and that I am forgiven, I can't help but extend that to the very people God chose to bring me into this world. I'm not saying that I just sweep under the rug any hurt or problems, but the edges start to fall off in light of my experience and in light of the gospel, even enough to possibly be honest with my parents. My parents have become more human to me, with the same desperate needs and insecurities I have. And I've always struggled with, well, how do I share the gospel message to people who are, they've got it all together, they're good people, they're wealthy, they're retired in a fancy town, and how do I demonstrate that they need something? And in my experience, in this whole experience, I feel that the best way that I demonstrate the gospel message is being able to listen listening to my mom, and also too, when we've had those moments where I could say, this thing that you did in my childhood really caused me to have all these insecurities later. And she looks at me and she says, "I never intended that, because I love you from the bottom of my heart." And I could say, "I forgive you." And that would not happen prior to having heard the gospel message.
I don't deal with my parent issues yet, so.
That's me.
I'll sit that one out.
I haven't, I mean, my dad, I mean, there was one time he didn't talk to me for like 4 or 5 months, and I was just like, when is dad going to like me again? And I don't know, he's 70-something, and I just sort of asked the question, what would it do to him right now to bring that up and be like, this is how you really failed me? I'd rather just love him, but that's where I am. Our relationships with our children and our parents will never be perfect because we are human, and in being human at this point in salvation history means to also be broken. We desperately need to continually hear the gospel message so that we are continually filled with the very love that loves us so much that it drove God to send his only son to reconcile us to himself. We cannot do it alone, and it cannot be on our shoulders. And to that I say praise be to God. Thank you.
I actually don't have any children, but I work with children. And something that I've been struggling with in the development of this after school program that I'm doing is love and the law and gospel, and it's secular, it's not a but how I'm just wondering any parenting techniques of identifying when the law is, you know, because like sometimes like someone's gonna get hurt, you know, and I don't know. I guess I just really struggle with
this
love and openness and being there for them and letting them fail and protecting them.
Well, I think that the common misperception from a more law gospel centered point of view about parenting is like, oh, whatever. And that children need structure. They need the law. And when Daniel and I miraculously function calmly and establish those boundaries and hem them in, they sleep with little silly smiles on their face, and we've actually seen it. But there is, they do desire that, and the law is good. And specifically in that, when they break the law, you come in with that other message. And that's really where I feel that if you're parenting without any sort of law or boundaries, that, well, what's broken, and where do you then demonstrate the bigger and final word, which is the yes, that they are loved apart from that failure of the deed or of the action, that you embrace them when they feel shame and they know when they've done something wrong. One parenting style that we really like for discipline is called love and logic. And one of their big things is empathy, 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 because the child doesn't need you to be like, see, I told you were going to fall down when you got back up on that stool. They know they fell. They hurt. So what you do is you come in and you're like, there, okay, I got you. I'm going to hold you for a while. And that's, I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. And that's, it's okay to have the law. It's the bigger message.
Hi, Lauren and Daniel.
Hi, Ethan.
just a thought, and see how you respond to it. We have kids that are a little younger than yours, and some of the same issues come up. And sometimes it's joyful, and other times it's totally heartbreaking. And one of the insights from the East that I kind of believe the opposite of is they have this notion of theosis, that when God becomes man, he does so in order that man should become God. Or I think it's probably just the opposite. In other words, God becomes man so that man can become a man, so that woman can become a woman, a true
human.
Being that Jesus was, of course, God, but also the truest human who's ever lived because he didn't have sinful nature. That aspect of your talk about becoming more human with our children seems to be the absence of control, that is the obsession with control, that's part of the fall. Gerhard Ferdy calls it an upward fall, right? Because we all want to be little gods running our own little worlds. And losing that and being able to apologize to our kids and admit mistakes was just, I just want to say thank you, because that's a good heartwarming reminder for me as a parent who frequently fails, but as a minister then tries to cover it up. So yeah, thank you.
Thus PK. That's why we have preacher's kids. Here, I'll give you my microphone.
Hi, I'm Holly, and I have an 8-month-old, but I also nanny for
an 18-month-old and a 7- and 10-year-old boy, two boys, and then the youngest ones are girls. So I feel like I went from no kids to not having a head. But I just had three smaller thoughts. And the first is that I've actually been more frustrated with my parents in having all these kids around. I think because my mom wants to be this, like, oh, I was this perfect parent who loved you so much, and let me tell you how I loved you. And she told me that her pregnancy was just amazing every moment. And I was like, Mom, I hate you. Like, that's just not reality. That's not what it was, but it was so long ago that she's forgotten. And so she now wants to sort of interpret everything. Like, I call and she says, you sound tired. And I'm like, I have a baby. You know, let's move on. And so that's frustrating to me, is that I just want her to accept reality. Just, okay, let's just see things as they are instead of having to have a reason behind everything. And then what I find in myself as a mother is that when someone says, oh, what's wrong with your baby? I immediately have to have an answer. It's almost entirely wrong every single time, but I just have that feeling of needing to know what's wrong with my daughter. And then lastly, I think this whole discussion so far this weekend has also been really supportive for this, in that it helps me to embrace the chaos of parenting. I mean, it's just utter chaos. And when I have four kids and I have two babies who are crying and the boys are fighting and one has a total disciplinary issue and fights me and scares me sometimes, and I go out and I see these mothers who are like super cute and their babies are in these like really posh little outfits, and they don't have spit up on them. They don't have snot all down their shirt. And, you know, they actually look clean and put together. Like, you wouldn't spot them and say, now they have kids. That I feel totally inept. And I like to sort of flaunt it sometimes, like as if it makes it better. Like, people will accept me more if I'm like, aren't I disheveled and pathetic? And so I feel like I like what you're saying, in that sort of taking ownership of being in chaos and of not having everything in control, and yet allowing God to have these children. Like, these aren't my children. As my husband likes to say, we're foster parents, and they're actually God's kids. So thank you for that. I feel sort of like less pathetic and more embracing my chaos. So thanks.
I do remember one time I was stressing. Well, first-time parent, you stress over just about everything your child's doing or not doing. And at this point, Quinn was really big, really huge head, and he wasn't rolling over or crawling or using his legs or really. He's just blob on the floor. And I was really, really stressed out, and other people were like, oh, he's 7 months. Why isn't he crawling yet? And I was like, and I just cracked, and I was like, I'm just happy that he could hold his big giant head up. And the legs, I think he'll learn to use. I'm pretty sure. And it just was kind of to like start saying those things. I was like, so what? He didn't walk until he was 13 months. You know, I don't know. Is that should I be making him walk, or, you know, but just being like, not being stressed out, and I don't know. Kids are funny.
I have just a few thoughts about what you said about theosis. And this is sort of creation-centered, so not so much justification of the sinner, although that's always in there. I don't know, do you know the Stephen Curtis Chapman song, Fingerprints of God? Is this so old that maybe you don't know this? But anyway, the words are something like, you're covered with the fingerprint. When I look at you, I see the fingerprints of God.
Absolutely.
So that's one thought that has helped me over the years. Another is, in all my failures, another thing that has helped is Paul in Corinthians, and I should know chapter and verse, and I can't remember, but it's, you are not your own, you are the Lord's. You are bought with a price. So glorify God in your bodies. And that I think is really important for our kids. Yes, our kids, but for ourselves, especially when, okay, so we're all failures at parenting, and that's true, but let's not beat ourselves up about it, because we are not our own, mm-hmm. and our kids mm-hmm. are not our own, like Holly said, mm-hmm. Matt said, your foster parents, and that there is an extent to which that's true, and yet we sort of wish we were, somebody take this child back, mm-hmm. you know. And about the whole issue of chaos, mm-hmm. I mean, that's huge, isn't it, for parents? And I think a lot of women and their the fathers of their children get to harbor this idea that this is not going to be chaotic mm-hmm. for 9 months. Mm-hmm. And we didn't, because I started into labor at 24 weeks, at which point the baby just would have died. Obviously, they do amazing things these days, but, you know, the fact is there's a point at which the baby is simply not viable, especially if it's born while you're walking down the hill from the divinity school to the Yale health plan to see what's wrong. Why are you having these contractions? In any event, I spent 7 weeks flat bed rest. I mean, I wasn't even supposed to be taking a shower. Simply to say that I think maybe these issues of control come really, really early. You know, I'm pregnant. This is going to go on great for 9 months. And I look now at women who are, like, out to here pregnant, and they're running. I have a parishioner who was doing that up until, like, her ninth and a half month. And I just can't believe that that's physically possible, that women can hold babies in like that. But anyway... Fingerprints of God, you are not your own, you are the Lord's. Yes, sinner, justified, but I think maybe for little kids, it's easier to understand the fingerprints of God kind of theology. I don't know.
I think some of these ideas were maybe covered already, so but I'll try and be brief. But you spoke about reading the parenting sleep books and so forth, and with our first child, I was quite keen to do that. My husband was like, there came a point where he's like, it's got to stop. You can't read another book. You can't have another strategy. Like, it's got to end. Because I was looking for the sort of the answer to what would make her sleep. So I think I absolutely learned, you know, a lot as a parent about just sort of the law there in a lot of this parenting literature and so forth, and to see it for what it is, and to be able to give yourself grace when your kid doesn't sleep and you don't know why. So that's kind of one hat I wear. And then on the other side, I work for UT's medical school, and I'm a researcher, and one of the things we do is research with parents, and we do parenting interventions with a lot of moms of preterm infants and other children who are at risk, and teach them how to use a more responsive parenting style. And so it's teaching them a lot of strategies and techniques and so forth. And just to, like, give you some context, you know, coaches go into their home and they do some things like they'll videotape the mom interacting with the child, and then they watch the video again and they think about, okay, well, what could you have done differently to be more responsive to this or that signal? So there's certainly plenty of law in that sort of coaching interaction. However, when you do studies of these families and how things turn out, the children have better outcomes socially, cognitively, and moms are less depressed. These moms are in very chaotic situations dealing with preterm infants who have a lot of things going on. So I don't know. I guess I wrestle myself personally and in my career with, you know, how to help parents learn how to be parents, because we don't intuitively know what we're doing. And you do need some strategies and techniques, and yet you also need to be able to see them for the law that they are and be able to know that the best evidence-based strategies will fail and so forth. So I don't know if you have any, I mean, obviously you have some experience in this too, but I don't know if you want to speak to it or just let it be a comment.
No, I actually really appreciate kind of you saying that, just because there is that, I guess, trying to strike that balance between seeing the tools and the tricks or the advice as helpful. And it is law. It's someone who's an expert in something telling you what to do. But it's for me, because I do so much study in regards to understanding the gospel and specifically law and gospel, and I know the power of the gospel, I'm always wrestling with, well, how much law? Just a little bit, this much. When do I apply it? Here, there. So I can relate to you in that regards. And I think that when I, looking at the tips and the tools and the tricks and the techniques, I see them as tools. For me, that I'm not supposed to try to morph myself into some parent that I'm not, but that I can take these things and make them my own. So when I talk about the love and logic parenting, we have a way of doing it that's, we have taken it, we've digested it, and now it looks something that like Lauren and Daniel do. And we ebb and flow and use intuition and discernment to depend on when is the consequence necessary. And, you know, Quinn's acting really upset. Maybe this isn't time for a consequence. And it's sort of that interplay and that delicate tension between, you know, for instance, you're always supposed to, you know, typically you should always have a consequence if they, you know, do something that breaks one of your laws. But there's certain times where I just get this sense that, you know, he's really upset about this. So maybe that's not the right time to come in heavy. You're exactly right. It's that he is so upset. But even with the sleep training, we did do sleep training, after a few months, there were times where, because they had established a sleeping situation where they weren't sleeping, and I knew there was something going on with them, and I could go in there and I could attend to them and I could hold them and I could. So it was taking the tools, reading them, throwing out the ones I didn't agree with, and making the ones that I liked mine. They looked like Lauren's tools. And so I don't know if that's sort of more of a response than it is. I kind of heard you make more of a statement. So, but that's sort of how I dealt with sort of like the existing tension between Daniel will probably roll his eyes, but my Myers-Briggs is like a flaming pea. So like, I'm always like, well, and so that's a little bit, you know, how I go about it, always discerning and using my intuition. And, you know I can tell by the, you know, the different lilt in the cry, whether or not this is a cry that I need to go in the bedroom for or ignore because it's, ooh, rebellion. So.
Can I just... One thing too. I think ultimately what I get out of this talk or this topic is that it's not so much about whether things work or don't work with your kids. It's more about how are you viewing yourself as a parent. You know, are you making parenting your identity? Because ultimately, any of those tricks could work or fail. And if you succeed, that's almost in some ways worse because then you've become this perfect parent and. That's really not where you should be putting your identity. So, you know, in some ways, I think it's almost two topics. You know, how do you raise kids with, you know, what tools do you use? But then also, who are you as a parent, you know? So.
Yeah, and we really do. I mean, you said it perfectly. Parenting isn't natural. Becoming parents is totally natural. Being parents is a completely different story.
I was just going to say, I had an older mom. We have a 2.5-year-old and a 4-month-old. And I had a mom tell me at one point, and this kind of plays off what you were just saying, Lauren. And she told me at one point, she said, if God's going to give anybody insight into your child, it's going to be you. And so sometimes the issue or the chaos, as we've been talking about, or the lack of control may just be that the Lord's wanting you to be dependent on him and just sit in a chair by yourself and just listen and just say, God, I have no idea. I mean, our latest issue was our oldest was stuttering. And I had no idea why she was stuttering. And just sitting before the Lord of, what's going on? Like, I'm just dependent on you for this. that I can't do anything. But if you're going to give anybody insight into my little Josephine's life, it's going to be me. And so I'm just going to sit and listen. And that's been huge for me, huge.
I actually had a pediatrician. I brought my child in, and he looked at him and said, he has allergies. And I said, no, he doesn't. And he's like, no, that kid has allergies, and put him on some brief allergy medicine. And came back, and he looked at my son, and he said, oh, I don't think he had allergies. And I was like, and he's like, you know, that's why I always say you trust the mother's intuition. And I was like, are you a doctor? It was the first time ever that I was like given credit for actually maybe knowing, you know, my son. Like, I see him every day. So, but yeah, I think that intuition, mother's intuition, I don't know if that's folklore or what, but I mean, there could be 50-100 babies crying, and I can like run straight towards the one that's mine, or, you know, like it's that. So one time we were at a creek, and we were having a little party, and the creek was far off, and a bunch of kids were playing with adult supervision. We're not that neglectful. And I heard a screech, and I was in the middle of a conversation, and I just bolted. And I came back with my youngest, Jack, and he was like, wah! And one of my friends who, she's now expecting her first, she looked at me really confused, and she was like, how in the world did you know it was Jack? And I was like, I don't know. It was just like everything inside of me was like, one of the fruit of your wombs is down in the creek. So, I mean, there is so much intuition, and you do know your child, and each child that you have is different from the next, and things we do with Jack are significantly different than we do with Quinn, and you know, they're different personalities, and so what worked with Quinn, we didn't work with Jack. And you know, like, my parents grounded my brother. He was a flaring extrovert and had to be out and about and socializing, so grounding was his torture. They grounded me, and I was like, sweet, I'm gonna be in my room playing Monopoly by myself. And they were like, why isn't this working? It's not amending any of her behavior. And then they realized that I was really obsessed with earning money. And then so they give me this really big allowance. And every time I do something wrong, it's like, oh, you're going to get a dollar docked. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I was like, perfect.
I would just like to offer a word of encouragement to all you young parents. I'm a grandmother. I have a 37-year-old son and a 33-year-old son. And they both have daughters. And I remember the screaming in the night. I had a colicky baby, and I remember thinking, I could throw this baby out the window. I don't know that I've ever even told my husband that, who's not in this room, but I will tell him today. But I remember that terrifying feeling. And but my sons are wonderful, and they're very, very different. I read the Dobson books, The Strong-Willed Child, The Compliant. I have one of each. We're the same people that raised them. And I do believe they come in a little package with some personality already there that has really nothing to do with their experience with you. So I just want to encourage you, pray for them, love them, pour grace upon them. My children, our children, my husband's a priest, and they have left the Lord. But I have not given up hope. And I pray for them every day and love them unconditionally. And I do not blame myself that they have chosen a more free path away from Him. I believe God's in them and will redeem this time. It's chaos, but grace is in it. And so I just want to encourage you. It can feel overwhelming, and but God carries you through. And just claim His promises. Pray for your children. And never give up.